What you mean is that you were right to believe that the coolie must hold something against you. So you did indeed kill someone who might well be harmless. But only because you could not have known that he was harmless. It happens sometimes with our police. They shoot into demonstrating crowds, a harmless crowd, but they shoot because they can only believe that these people are going to drag them off their horses and lynch them. These policemen shoot out of fear, and their fear is that of the reasonable man. What you mean is that you could not have known that this coolie was an exception to the rule.
The theater, the theater.
Bring out Louis!
Theater, theater.
To be or not to be.
Theater, theater.
Hey, friends.
Hello, friends.
How you doing?
Well.
Oh, Siege, that was intense.
Wow.
That's fucking great.
Jesus.
Have y'all been seeing any theater recently? LA theater?
Or thereabouts? Just small stuff. Like, I've seen some readings, did a reading, some smaller stuff, doing another reading. But you've seen a show.
I did. I saw Oklahoma at the Broadway National Tour of Oklahoma! Exclamation point. Which is currently beginning its tour, I believe, in LA. I think we were the start of the tour. I could be wrong.
Lucky us.
Yeah. So I went to opening night. Got a comp.
Yeah.
And I went and I was like, okay, you know, we've covered Oklahoma. Trav, I think you probably listened to this episode, and we probably have already had a discussion about it at the bar, but we watched the movie Oklahoma long ago as a bonus episode. It was one of our, like, Pam pick eps, and Scott chose it, and we were all kind of mad at him, but then it was fun to talk about. So we were actually quite mad at you, Scott. It's okay.
I deserved it.
No, it's fine.
But no, we have to have fodder as much as we have, you know, good stuff that we all love.
Yeah, yeah, we gotta have bad stuff too. But I was told by many people that this new Oklahoma was in fact a reclamation, you know, something that was gonna sort of reinvigorate Oklahoma and bring it back. Yeah, and I was like, can't be done, but sure, let's go. Let's go see it.
Right.
And, you know, I heard the casting was really representative and diverse and interesting and kind of different. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to get too deep into it because I don't want to shit talk too much. I did leave at intermission. Now, that's not something I often do anymore. I used to do it a lot in college because I was really pretentious, but now I don't do it if a friend is in the show. I don't do it if I know people involved. I don't, you know, like, because it's like, why would I do that? There's no point.
Yeah.
I'm here to support. But also, I don't go to the Amundsen. I don't go to Center Theater Group shows, national tour shows, to support the artists necessarily.
Right.
I go to see theater and to, like, be challenged and to escape
and
enjoy myself.
And,
like, if none of that's happening and I've been there an hour and a half and intermission hits and I'm sleepy, I'm going to go home. Now, I had a lot of problems with the directing. It was, in fact, directed to be in the round and was very Brechtian, actually. Hence, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more.
Yeah.
But I couldn't handle it anymore, and I have a lot to say about it, and I won't go down that path because it would turn into a whole episode about it. But we can talk more about it sometime, maybe on a bonus ep. Maybe we'll talk about it on the Wiz live ep coming up, because there's a lot of musical talk to be had on that. But it just wasn't for me, and the director handprints were the biggest issue I had, where it just felt like a director being like, and then we're going to change this line to be said like this, even though they didn't change any words.
Right.
It was all like, we're going to change the intention behind this and make it like this. And it was like, yeah, but you, you can't just do that for every line. It doesn't add up to anything.
Right.
Yeah. So it was not good. A lot of people really love it. So I'm sorry that I have a different opinion than you.
One of the tweets that I saw was like, this is sort of a glorious failure in that it doesn't work, but they're trying. They're trying. I just want to know, like...
Yeah, I guess. Like, the design is really lazy, in my opinion. A lot of people are like, no, it's beautiful. And I was like, it's not. It's
well, the pictures okay, I've seen, I'm not impressed by.
But... It's lazy.
All right. Anyway.
Anyway, we're talking theater. We love theater here because it is, in fact, a podcast about theater. So welcome to Theater. Theater.
Yeah.
The theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the L.A. theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Bertram.
I'm C.J. Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
And each week we get together to discuss, debate, and disseminate the evolutions of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at three of their plays. And this is part one of three of our mini-series covering the works, three whole episodes, covering the works of Bertolt Brecht.
Yeah.
Grab your schnitzel, everybody.
And grab that schnitzel, fucking schnitzel.
Get your brats. That's right. It's three podcast opera.
Hey. All right. I like that.
We will not be covering Three Penny Opera on this miniseries. During this series, we'll be taking a macro look at the plays Ball, The Mother,
Yes,
not Mother Courage, but The Mother, and Caucasian Chalk Circle.
Yes.
And this week, we are joined by a very special guest, a writer, performer, producer, listener of the pod, friend of all of us, a Brecht aficionado, and an actual Brecht adapter.
Yes.
Yes.
Like, the truest of contexts, if there ever was one, with our playwright. Buddy to us all, Travis Gatz, everyone. Hey, Trav!
Welcome!
Bow, 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 bow.
You know what's
up, y'all? How's it going?
Good, man. How are you? Now, people can listen to your artist spotlight to get to know you a lot better, but that was a while back. So
yeah. That was a while back,
Give
yeah.
us a little fill-in of what you've been up to since then. What you got going on?
I've returned to the stage as an actor for the first time in like 5 years and been doing that a little more consistently now, working out those chops. I adapted In the Jungle of the Cities by our very own B.B. Bertolt Brecht.
Yep.
Which
we all saw and enjoyed and had many a discussion afterwards about.
Thank you. Yeah. And we got approval from the state and stuff to do it for free, which was really cool and made me feel special.
Nice.
Directed a few shows and started writing some more, both in the epic fashion and not in the epic fashion. So, you know.
Wow.
Just doing the work and seeing what's gonna go down. And me and Scott actually have a reading coming up on Thursday for another play that we get to be in together.
Yeah.
That's a Chris Haas, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Chris play.
Oh, hey, cool. I saw a Chris Haas play this past Fringe.
Nice.
Across the River? Was that the name of
it? Yeah, or like something
Meeting across the River.
Yeah,
Meeting Across the River. Yeah.
Meeting Across the River, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw that too. Hey, Chris.
Alice Childress.
Oh,
we saw Loft.
Well, you got to see me name every president on stage.
Yes, you did.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That's fun. It's like naming all the colors in the Joseph Amazing and Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Do you want me to do it right now?
It was more a role where you got to be on stage for an hour saying almost nothing and then just go on a 6-minute monologue, which was a lot of fun.
I mean, that's also kind of Brechtian in a weird way.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, so we're excited to have you here, mostly because you know Brecht better than all of us, probably pretty easily, I think I would say. I don't know, Scott, how well you know Brecht, but I don't really. I've read some, I've seen some, I've studied him as most do in school.
Yeah.
In theater school, to be specific.
Yeah.
But we're excited to cover this with you. Today, we're talking about Ball.
Yeah.
And then we like to kind of understand where everybody's coming from in terms of where they actually, how they know Brecht, Bertolt himself.
Yeah.
What a name. Bertie. Bertolt? Bert?
Bertie.
Bert.
Oh, okay.
I believe at the time of the play we're talking about, he went by Bert.
Bert?
Yes. Either Bert or BB.
Like Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins.
Wow, yeah.
His family called him Dinky, though.
Just like that character from that movie that guy played. Yeah, hilarious. Sure. Okay, so CJ, I want to beat you up right now. I love you so much. Okay, let's talk about it. I want to hear your context. Let's start with my beautiful co-host, Scott.
Thank you. Yeah.
I can't wait to hear which co-host I am.
No, you're beautiful too. I'm just saying my beautiful co-host. Scott, tell us, like, how do you know Brecht? How do you know Bert?
I was introduced in college, and I can't remember what the hell. I think we read Mother Courage, like, sure, in class, and then I did we did selections from Fear and Misery in the Third Reich as part of my senior acting class thing, and that's really the big stuff. I've since seen productions of Ball, I've seen productions of Mother Courage, I saw a production of Caucasian Chalk Circle, that's really it. It's very academic, which will be kind of my theme throughout our discussions about...
It's rare on this podcast that we get academic, so
we're not academic, and...
If you're going to take the test, listen to a different podcast.
Exactly, because we're about to go off. But my thesis is kind of like, I think that a lot of... how we perceive him is because of academia and not because of the work itself. I think it's been taken over a little bit and over intellectualized. But that I'll get off of that soapbox right now. We'll get more into it later. But yeah, that's kind of my thing. Like college, and I did some stuff. So yeah,
Siege.
None. I maybe we were made to read Three Penny Opera or Mother Courage in college. I don't remember it. I've never seen it. I've never read it. Travis had me sit down and watch a really cool video of Nina Simone perform a song from Three Penny Opera, right, Trav? And that he's nodding yes. And then the other one...
on an audio format.
I know that Brecht loved B. Arthur. That's all I know.
Yeah, late in his life. Yeah. I was sort of lied to about that. I was told that she was like full on like his muse.
Yeah.
And that's not true.
Right.
Not necessarily. Like, I thought, like, it doesn't matter. Okay, we'll get into it later. Because B. Arthur is one of my gals.
I mean, Brecht and I have that in common. I do love B. Arthur.
Yeah, same. yeah, exactly. No, okay, so I was in the Three Penny Opera. When I was in high school, I was a sophomore in high school, and I got a call from this woman who produced a lot of theater around town, and they were using the Scottish Rite Center, which was an old Masons, an old Masons temple, but it was huge castle in the middle of downtown Wichita, and if you went upstairs, there was like... a little like Egyptian themed library that had like Nazi text in it, right?
Whoa.
Like it was like a very, it was a hardcore place.
Wow.
Like, you know, Mein Kampf was there, like was just at the light, was in
Christ.
That library. So it was
Welcome
a weird place
Midwest, everybody.
And everyone called it haunted and there were stories surrounding it all the time. But we did Three Penny Opera. I was one of Mack the Knife's gang. There's like a trio that are sort of like his dudes.
Yeah.
My name was Matt. I think was my name, Matt, sounds right.
Okay.
And they made us like do like Tim Burton makeup and like all this kind of stuff, but it was so much fun. And I fell in love with it actually, because it was my first time being introduced to because it was introduced to me as a musical, as just straight up like, this is a musical theater show, but
right.
Then it's so not, it like formulaically not a musical theater show, musically not a musical theater show, and we'll get into all of the reasons why with his other shows, but I, for the first time, was sort of like, oh shit, it doesn't have to just be like a perfect Disney fairy tale that's tied up in a bow.
Right.
Sometimes it can just be like in your face, like, fuck you, like theater. And I, you know, when Ginny is singing, or not Ginny, whatever, there's, oh yeah, Ginny Peachum is singing Pirate Ginny, and the whole audience is going like, why is our heroine singing this horrifying, like, crazy song? Like, I just was introduced to a lot during that show. So cool. That was a big thing for me. Then in college, Mother Courage, maybe like four or five others. Caucasian Chalk Circle was a huge one we read. And then I saw Caucasian Chalk Circle at the KC Rep and loved it. And then we sort of discussed it, and it got kind of like stripped down from where I started to not love it once my like mentor started being like, this is why their production didn't work. And I was like, oh no.
Uh-huh.
And I, so since then I've had like an interesting relationship with him where I've never fully felt like I connect with the way that he views theater. And I think that's why maybe I don't always, it doesn't always work for me, or, and we'll get to this. I don't want to get into my whole thesis on him. We have three episodes to do that. I'll lay little Easter eggs and crumbs along the way until we get to my final opinion on him. But I have said it on the podcast before, but I just don't really know how I feel about him always. And so I'm interested to actually dive in and get to know him better. But Trav, what is your context with him? How were you introduced to him? What was your like initial relationship with him before you got into him?
Yeah. When I was in college, my freshman year, I was in acting studio, which was the advanced acting class. We only had two levels. And my goal was I wanted to play darker characters, like any college freshman wants to do.
Yeah.
And my professor handed me a copy of Ball and said, you should look at this one. It's not on the list, but you might like it. So I read Ball, and it was like the first like classic play that really just was like, oh, this is what I did, because it's what any young fucking early adult boy would be drawn to.
Sure, it's like showing Tarantino drunk for the first time.
Yeah. And it was like, oh, you could have a fucking womanizer drunk on stage doing all this crazy stuff. So that's kind of how I was introduced to him. And then like Bailey, I also did Three Penny Opera. I acted in it, and that was my first like dramaturg gig in college.
That's cool.
I got a dramaturg for my professor, and also he was very in touch with his like Brecht knowledge. Like, he was a good he was like a good a big like Brechtian like director. He used to be people have probably heard of my artist spotlight, he was a collaborator with Joe Chaykin, who did stuff like Man Equals Man, stuff like that. But he also knew people like, what is his name that just blanked? One of Breck's big translators, anyway. It'll come up to me later. But so he knew like Willett, John Willett. Okay. So kind of like working with him, I got to learn a lot about Brecht in that way. And the way we did Three Penny was we kind of just pieced a bunch of translations together and adapted some of the scenes to make it more modern day, which is, we'll go into later on, that's kind of with Brecht's whole theory of things. But that was like my first real big like attempt to do a Brecht thing. Then for my senior when my senior project was coming around, I did all the prep to direct Ball. And then got denied, only for them to give it to POS after. But
I know who that POS is.
Fuck that motherfucker.
Yeah. But so I actually, the first one we're going to talk about, I actually know pretty well. I have a very intimate relationship with it. It's also not in my top 10 Brecht plays.
Nice.
Fun fact. The play, my professor said something about like loving this like really punk rock painter when he was in college, and then being a big Michelangelo fan later on.
Right.
I feel that's kind of what it's like for me, where I was like, I love this play, and then I read it like later on, I'm like, this is subpar.
And Trev, you and I were we had been discussing, because you really wanted to be a part of it, and it probably would have happened, we just hadn't even gotten to that point yet. I was set to direct an immersive Three Penny Opera when COVID hit.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was working with Two Cents Theater Group with Kristen Boulay, and we had set our season, and I was gonna be doing Hedwig and the Angry Inch and like some like really amazing stuff that season. And I said, I wanna do a fully immersive, fully Brechtian, like kind of fuck you Brechtian, like musical theater with Three Penny Opera, and make it like immersive in like a warehouse somewhere. And I told Travis about it one night, and he was like, oh, I want to be part of that. And I was like, you're going to be part of this. So we did, but it never happened. We never got to make it happen.
That makes me think of Dionysus in 69. We're going to have to cover that sometime.
I just don't want to play anybody big in the Three Penny. I just want to play the street singer. I just want to sing those two songs.
Yeah. You know, Roger Daltrey did it in the musical movie that they made.
Oh, right.
It's pretty good. Do you know who played the role when it first premiered on Broadway?
Who first? Oh, on Broadway? I don't know. Who?
Louis Armstrong.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. That's so cool.
That's cool.
That's why he has that cover of it and stuff like that.
Sure. But, yeah, of course. His Mac the Knife is super famous.
Yeah. When it like premiered and bombed, they had Louis Armstrong playing the street singer.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. There's been a lot of iterations of that. Unfortunately, we're not talking Three Penny, but we are talking Ball. But before we get into Ball, there's another segment that we like to do just so we can know a little bit more about Bertie. Bertie. Yeah.
Bet.
But what's the accent? What accent are we doing right now?
I was doing Julie Andrews in Mary Poppins.
You're trying. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Scottopedia.
Ooh, okay, so a couple disclaimers before we get into this. There's a lot about fucking Bertolt Brecht. Like this dude was documented well. There's no mystery. it's like every fucking detail, every time he wiped his ass, there's a Wikipedia entrance for
it. Well, he was a big deal. I mean,
he was a big deal, and he was surrounded by writers and who kept writing about him and all of it. Yeah,
I feel like he's on par with someone we covered recently, Oscar Wilde, but who was alive at a time where they weren't really documenting the same way that they were when Bertie was doing it, right? Yeah. Like by the, because Bertolt dies in the 50s, is that right? Well, you'll get there.
Yeah,
but I just feel like it's a better time for documenting the theater in general.
Right.
Okay.
So we're going to get into it. I do have two truths and a lie to play at the end.
I don't know that Travis gets to play that, though, because he might know everything.
He might know everything. I think I might be able to throw him. I was thinking about him as I did it. And then I'm gonna throw in, when we get there, I'm gonna throw in a little epic theater definition thing. Okay. Just so that we can sort of set the stage. Mm-hmm. Eugen Bertolt Friedrich Brecht was born on... Yeah. Eugen
Bertolt. He has more names than Oscar Friedrich Wilde, I think.
Brecht was born on February 10th, 1898 in Augsburg, Germany. Oh. He's the son of Bertolt Friedrich Brecht, and his mother's name was Sophie. Brecht's mother was a devout Protestant, and his father a Roman Catholic. Is that important anymore? I guess it is, and I guess in time, like, it just shouldn't be. It's like,
it's still bullshit going on in my family between Catholics and Protestants.
Dear Lord,
fucking stupid.
Let's let it go, people.
Yeah.
The modest house where he was born is today preserved as a Brecht Museum. The gift shop there's got to suck, right? Like, I mean, Trav's got a cool t-shirt on, but it's like, hey, did you go to the Brecht Museum? It's like, hey, I got my Brecht wall calendar.
Yeah,
and my Brecht hat and a keychain. Like my Brecht keychain. Like, what do you, I don't know.
I'd want a shower curtain.
I just was like, some Brecht merch.
I would probably do it too. And if I was there, I certainly would go to it. I would absolutely visit.
Maybe we should start Brecht merch.
Y'all are making fun of the top shelf of my bookshelf. Right?
Sorry, buddy. Due to his grandmother and his mother's influence, Brecht knew the Bible, a familiarity that would be a lifelong effect, that would have a lifelong effect on his writing. He had a very comfortable middle-class upbringing, despite his attempts at claiming a peasant origin throughout his life. Especially got more Marxist. That makes sense. World War One broke out when Brecht was 16. He was initially stoked about it, but when he saw his classmates, quote, swallowed by the army, end quote, he changed his mind and was almost expelled from school for writing an essay arguing that only an empty-headed person could be persuaded to die for their country.
Damn.
Yeah, dude. I was like, yeah, he gets
some
punk
big
rock.
Thoughts
he,
for a high schooler.
He gets metal. He gets metal throughout his
All
life.
All right. I dig him.
In 1917, he enrolled at Munich University, where he began studying drama. He began writing newspaper articles and theater reviews under the name Bert Brecht. Sometime either around 1920, 1921, Brecht took a small part in the political cabaret of the Munich comedian Karl Valentin, and that would have a huge impact on the rest of his life. In 1918, he writes his first play, which was Ball, and we'll get to that in just a second. In 1922, while still living in Munich, Brecht came to the attention of an influential Berlin critic, Herbert Hering. I'm going to mess up these German names horribly. At 24, and Mr. Ehring said of Bertolt Brecht, at 24, the writer Bert Brecht has changed Germany's literary complexion overnight. So he had a lot of attention on him for a 24-year-old. In 1927, Brecht became part of the dramaturgical collective of Erwin Piscators.
Piscator.
Nice. Thank you. Thank you very much. His first company, which was designed to tackle the problem of finding new plays for its, quote, epic, political, confrontational documentary theater. During this time, Brecht helps define the epic theater movement along with other practitioners who responded to the political climate of the time through the creation of new political dramas. Epic theater is not meant to refer to the scale or the scope of the work, but rather to the form that it takes. Epic theater emphasizes the audience's perspective and reaction to the piece through a variety of techniques that deliberately cause them to individually engage in a different way. The purpose of epic theater is not to encourage an audience to suspend their disbelief, but rather to force them to see their world as it is.
Right. The quote is like, the substance of theater, or the purpose of theater, is to teach. And like, it's a hammer. What's that one quote? I always forget that one.
Oh, it's on my
quote.
Shirt. Let me read it to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Art is not a mirror held up to reality, but a hammer with which to shape it.
Yeah, fuck that. But we'll talk about that later.
So in 1927, also saw the first collaboration between Brecht and the young composer Kurt Weill. They would go on to do Three Penny Opera. In 1930, Brecht married Helene Weigel, which was technically his second marriage. He had a first marriage. His son died in World War II fighting for the Nazis, but he didn't have much of a relationship with him. But with his second marriage to Helene, they had a daughter named Barbara Brecht, who was soon
after... Babs Brecht.
Babs Brecht, yes. And she became an actress and would later share the copyrights of Brecht's work with her siblings. Throughout the 20s and 30s, this dude is busy as a motherfucker. He's writing, he's directing, he's collaborating, he's infusing philosophy and psychology into his theater work. As things went on, though, into the early 30s, fearing persecution, Brecht left Nazi Germany in February of 1933, right after Hitler came to power. Basically, he hopped around Europe. He was in Prague, he was in Zurich, he was in Paris. He worked in Denmark a little bit, and basically he's waiting for his visa, and in 1941 he gets his visa to come to the United States. He spent time in the States, mostly here in L.A., writing articles. He did write a co-script with Fritz Lang that was produced. And,
oh, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
And then he was blacklisted from Hollywood for his writings and his philosophy.
That was the un-American thing or whatever? I remember learning about that.
Yeah.
You mean 2022?
Right. Yeah. No, be careful. In October 1947, he was subpoenaed to testify in front of the House of on Un-American Activities Committee. He denied being a communist. As soon as the meeting was over, he went to New York, got on a boat, and went back to Europe.
Cancel culture.
Yeah, right. Then he bounced around Europe again when he got back, but he eventually ended up in East Berlin, where he put together the Berliner Ensemble, and they were doing
production. Which still exists, right?
Still exists, yeah.
Yeah.
But he started writing less and less. His health declined, and he died on August 14th, 1956, of a heart attack at the age of 58. Like, he was
too young.
But I got two truths and a lie. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
All right. Number one. Brecht was an avid skier and marksman and almost tried out for the German Olympic biathlon team. Brecht was friends with Charlie Chaplin, and they exchanged notes on various projects. Brecht used costume glasses while appearing before the House on Un-American Activities Committee. Which of those three is the truth? And or oh, which is a lie? Is no, which one's a lie?
I think Chaplin is a lie.
Okay.
I'm unsure if him and Chaplin were friends. I know that he would claim that Chaplin was the epitome of the epic actor, but I'm going to go with A.
Okay. You're saying that, okay. We'll recap in just a second. Come on, Siege.
I'm going to go with the first one. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So Travis and CJ are saying that the lie is that Brecht was an avid skier and marksman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't really track for me, but I am like, that's pretty cool. And I don't know, maybe not. I don't know. Keep going.
Watch it be the third.
Bailey is saying that it was that Chaplin and Brecht were not friends. Or he doesn't believe that one.
I don't believe it.
Okay.
I don't believe it.
I think he's too cool for Chaplin.
Travis Ooh. And CJ are correct. He was not an avid skier nor marksman.
Yeah, he's too goofy.
You're both he and Chaplin. Though,
fun fact, he was a very good driver. He used to like to drive cars and all the time.
That's
was
why
one
he lived in L.A.
I think I just want the first one to be true.
Yeah, no, I got you. Yeah. I have to tell the story real quick about the glasses, wearing the costume glasses for the appearing before the McCarthy trials. And so he wore glasses, but he went and he found a big rimmed, like, so that his eyes literally would look bigger and more innocent. And then he feigned his English, not speaking English. So they used.
I think I heard that part before.
And so they used a translator, and he basically just bobbed and weaved. Like every time he was asked a question, he would kind of go, I don't know. I don't understand. You know, were you ever a member of the Communist Party? I don't like parties. Like, and like, he just like ducked and weaved because he was a communist. And
God,
well,
fucking
certainly
politicians
a Marxist.
Are stupid.
Well, so
as shit.
Lucille Ball at one point. So it's, you know, because she didn't know what she was signing.
She didn't know what she was signing. Yeah.
But anyway, can I add something to your little recap, Scott?
Yeah.
That I feel is just very important when talking about Brecht.
Travopedia.
Though his name is Brecht, and he's the big man on campus, he wouldn't have been Brecht. His theories wouldn't be what they were, and Three Penny Opera probably wouldn't have existed if it wasn't for folks like Helen Weigel and Elizabeth Hoppman and Ruth Berlow, who were his frequent collaborators, especially Elizabeth Hoppman, who was in fact translating Word. Three Penny Opera when it was coming out, and then Piscator was like, hey, we need somebody to open this season, and he's like, well, my girlfriend or my partner is working on this translation. He was also a bi polyamorous person, is working on this translation of The Beggar's Opera. Let's do that. I mean, Kurt Vile have been working on Mahogany, but we could transfer over to this thing. And so kind of from there, him and Hoppman really were like together. Like if you go into a lot of his later plays, Hoppman's name is on pretty much everything as a collaborator.
Yeah, to the point where like there has been discussion of like how much did he write, and not in the like Shakespearean way of like we don't know what's his and what's, but there is discussion of sort of like, well, like there's enough collaboration where, like you're saying, Trav, like without those people, it probably wouldn't be what it is. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of just the face of it all, the name of it all. So much so that there's just like that little bit of, well, the discussion mostly surrounds the fact that his female characters are really well written, and there's like really good, not well written's a bad way to say it. What I really mean is they're good parts.
Yeah.
And it's a, a lot of people, a lot of women would be excited to play those roles, especially even in a modern day. But the question sort of becomes, was he the reason they're so, you know, there's such good parts, or was it because of these collaborators that he had?
I think it was a big collaboration thing. And I think it's just, it's because he worked with like a translator, Berlot as a director, Weigel was a actress, to where I think it was just he wanted to collaborate and he loved all these women so much. As toxic as like him and Weigel's relationship may have been, stuff like that, it seems that he truly did love them in his own weird way. And he has an interesting past too, like, but
well, and what keeps coming up again and again is collectives. He's in collectives. He's forming collectives. He's drawn to that, which might be one of the biggest things that I admire about him, is that he did view theater as the communal art that we all love about it, you know, that I think sometimes gets lost, is that he was definitely into collaborating. But he was also, he didn't hide taking credit for stuff either. So,
yeah. True. Also, another funny story, since we're all in a small theater in LA, I think this will be hilarious to all of us, is the reason him and Kurt Vile, their like relationship got sour and they stopped working with each other, was because during Three Petty, he forgot to put Lottie Lenya's name in the program.
Oh,
and I read it, I'm like, that's the most like LA 99 seat theater thing ever.
Vanity.
I think they just forgot. I think they were just overwhelmed putting a show up in like a summer.
Right.
Right.
I just found it hilarious.
No, that's hilarious. I think, yeah, people would still do that now. Absolutely. I feel like, you know, it's interesting that where he ends up with Epic Theater and the sort of, you know, coming out of the late 1800s, early 1900s theater of naturalism and like realism, where everything was like, everyone was like really obsessed with it, like being real. I want a real working wood fire on stage, and you know, and all this stuff. He was combating that, right? He was combating the true naturalism, which was, he's basically like, fuck that. Why are we pretending we're in a kitchen? We're not. Let's acknowledge we're in a theater. Like, we're not idiots. Which I, you know, I have opinions on. But I think what's interesting about him is that he doesn't really react in that way until later. He does some Brechtian things in this first one we're going to talk about, but he doesn't get into true epic theater until his like sort of second and third seasons of writing.
Man, I'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Which we can get into the next two episodes. But this episode, this is early. This is his first work. It's kind of raw. It's definitely like a first outing. But I think there's a lot to discuss here. So let's get into it. This is Baal, B-A-A-L, Siege.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's about.
Yeah.
But I know you do.
Yeah.
Can you tell me?
Yeah.
CJ's breakdown.
Baal is a mildly talented poet that is given everything and repeatedly forgiven or forgotten because of it. He goes through life being a soaked, abusive, intolerant rapist and eventual murderer. Maybe because of some unnamed trauma? Maybe because he can't deal with his attraction to men? NC-17, Peer Gynt.
That's a great way to put it. It's actually a perfect way to put it, and I felt the same way, because when we talked about Peer Gynt, I was like, this is such a first outing. You can see some things that are Ibsen-esque, but that don't, but you can see why he gets better, and I feel that here. I do like this play. I think it's interesting. Obviously, and you showed your feelings on it, which I'm glad you did see. Because there's a lot to say here. It's a very cynical piece, yes. The point, of course, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm just saying this to spark discussion, is, in my opinion, all of Brecht, sort of the point becomes like to present characters that we shouldn't be relating to, and therefore if we are relating to them, then it's an issue and we should stop.
Sure.
Whatever we're doing. Whereas, like, Paula Vogel presents us with characters who are problematic, who we actually are able to see the human in.
Yeah.
He's doing sort of the opposite and being like, he's like, oh, you feel like this person? You should probably stop doing what you're doing then, because this person's fucked up. This is not a hero here. And Ball is definitely the beginnings of that, right? It's sort of the epitome of that.
This is my main oversweeping thing about this, and I have a lot of things to say too, and maybe I'm going to kind of be the cynical eye-rolly bitch through this whole thing.
No.
But I get to a point, and I totally hear you, and that's a great way to think of it, Bailey, and I wish I'd come up with that while I was reading it. But I'm bitching about this in modern day too, with Game of Thrones or any of this shit. I get to the point where I can't watch another person, especially in these situations, women, be mistreated and abused on stage. I get to a point where I'm like, I get it. I get it.
Yeah.
And it after a while is like, okay, here we go again. He's doing this again, you know, and almost just it elevates, which I guess is another thing it's saying. Like, if you don't curtail this behavior and do something about it or put them away or make them learn from their mistakes, it's just going to escalate and the treatment is going to get worse.
People put this up all the time, Ball, all the time, and a lot of the reviews do tend to follow that sort of like, we just don't really need to see this anymore. And there was one production that even cast him with a female with an actress, and they were, and the reviews were still sort of like,
right,
it doesn't make it better. Doesn't change anything, you know.
Which,
so I don't
also
know.
Poor Ball, between Brecht and the Bible, that poor fucking God got a bad rap.
For me, and I don't mean to be reductive about it, but I've always known, for the two or three productions I've seen of it, for the times I've read it, I've always known that this is his first play and that he was 20 years old when he wrote it.
Yeah.
So there's this young, dumb, and full of cum bravado that permeates.
That's a really good way to put it.
That permeates through it, and you know, and I mean, he wasn't the first or the last. You know, I think about Jim Morrison, you know, who sort of wrote on similar kinds of coattails. This sort of, you know, the rogue poet, you know, pushing the boundaries of life and existence and sexuality and all that. I just wish, and in reviewing it this time, because I didn't reread it until after you had sort of made a few comments, Siege, about your reading of it. And I was with you, and because I know that there's stuff about Breck's sexuality, and maybe that I felt like there was some definite repression there. I felt like if he would have been fucking dudes too throughout it, like but he couldn't have done that, I don't think, in whatever year that was, 1918 that he wrote it. But
Breck was getting with dudes.
What?
Brecht was getting with dudes.
Yeah, I knew.
Ball is not.
But Ball isn't. And I don't think that he would have been allowed to have shown that. But that's something that you could tell he almost wants to. But yeah, and it is part of the evolution. And Trav brought up the women earlier, that you can see that there's just a disregard for women, for me, in it, that undermines some of the cool things that happen, some of the cool things that are said, some of the cool thoughts that are expressed in it.
But then at the same time, lots of womb talk. Lots of womb talk.
Yeah, definitely.
Which made me think, like, okay, so there's some kind of unnamed trauma here, which, you know, I mean, I guess it's interesting. I'm sure this would have been shocking back in the day, putting it up on stage. But also, it's like we have so much more vocabulary now for, like, why someone is doing that and why someone is drinking that much and why someone is acting that crazily. Whereas then you're just kind of putting it out there and showing it to people back then.
Right.
So in previous versions of this play, it was more focused on like the mother being like more of a prime character. A lot of these scenes have been like rearranged throughout the entire play also, except a couple of big plot points.
It's definitely been deconstructed and reconstructed a lot.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, he's like, we say it's his first play from the from him when he was 20, but he's this is probably one of the longest plays he worked on. And it
he did like a full rewrite in 26 or something.
Yeah. So like I look at it more like 26 to 30 was when he wrote this play, because he rewrote it a little once he started going, oh, epic theater and getting that idea in there. But also something about Ball is the character of Ball is something that he created with his friend Casper Neher, who he's known since grade school. And like Casper was his set designer his whole
life. Yeah, they knew each other for years and years.
And in Ball, Brecht, they're pretty much similar people, which I could go into also. Brecht had a cult, fun fact. He had like this picture drawing that Casper did of Ball, like for a while, even before he started writing it. And it was to demonstrate what he called the hydropyranthropus, which kind of goes through his entire life, which he classifies as the water fire person. Mm-hmm. And it'd say that we as people are made of contradictions of water and fire. And that's kind of what he tries to do with Ball. It also goes to say that creating this, there's a lot of like rumor going around that he wrote it in like 4 days and for a bet, which is not true. He actually, he had this professor, Arthur Kuscher, who was doing a theater seminar in Munich University and would always talk up this Hans Joss dude, who was a novelist and a playwright, who was an expressionist, and he later wrote Nazi plays. He kind of wrote this as an argument going, well, this is bullshit what you're writing, I'm gonna write something better. And he even kind of admired Hans Joss, but he wanted to kind of like make a like name and a statement about the bullshit that this dude was doing.
We should also note too that we're at an era where Freudianism is starting to spread, and it's spreading from Austria. So the idea that he's talking about Oedipal complexes, that those are conversations that are being had, I haven't read that. It's just a thought that may have had an influence about him talking about, because the mother's an entity in this more than a character of any kind.
We never actually meet. I mean, no. I read two versions of this script. I read a translation. I read an adaptation. I didn't see any mother. The closest thing we got was his landlady.
Mm. Right.
And then there's mothers constantly mentioned. It's the mothers of the girls that he's getting pregnant or that he's dragging into sin.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I saw Sacred Fools did a production of it years ago when I was artistic director, directed by Ben Rock. That I don't think worked overall, but had, it was a more contemporary translation and had, it's got a bravado that I kind of admire. It does go balls out. But again, I couldn't emotionally connect to it. And this isn't, what he becomes too. It's an interesting starting point as we get into next week's episode and talking about the evolution of playwrights, which is what we do here. This is going to be an interesting point for us to come back to, an interesting base to come back to, I think.
There's this interesting, we kind of already talked about this, but I think it's worth mentioning that moving forward from this, all of his plays sort of follow horrible people. Like, we're never really going to get out of that in any of these, right?
So like, he's like old-timey Seinfeld.
Wait till the next one.
Yeah, the next one especially. I mean, because it's this kind of, it's Seinfeld. He's Larry David. But I think, because a great example of this is Threepenny Opera. I brought this up earlier, but in Three Podcast Opera, the Peachums. I love this show, by the way, and it's weird how much I love this show. I think it's mostly just because I was in it, but then like working on it so deeply, about to direct it. But the Peachums, their entire business, they sort of call themselves like he calls himself the king of the beggars, but really what it is he sends out beggars onto the street to beg, and then he just takes whatever they bring back. So they don't get to keep anything. And he, like, doesn't let them, you know, he, like, searches their clothes and makes sure that they don't keep anything. It's that kind of thing. So he's going to do that through the rest of his plays, where he's trying to show us, like, the shittiness of the bourgeoisie, the problems in the classes. He's kind of like George Carlin, in a way, except with, like, kind of less to say. But because in theater, there are basically two ways of talking about social change, right? We talk about this a lot on this podcast, but one way is everything is bad. Let's do something about it. Activism. And the other way is everything is bad. Oh, well, there's nothing to be done.
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Fuck it. Right. And I think although Brecht is semi-activist in the way that he is presenting a lot of these things.
Sure.
He's also a little bit, oh, well, there's nothing to be done. And I think politically nowadays, Siege, when we watch this play in particular, I actually think it's more offensive now maybe than it was then.
Sure. I could agree with that,
and
for sure.
And I think, although it was provocative, I think now it would be even harder to watch, which is why modern directors try to recast based in weird shit like gender and stuff. And you're just like, okay, it's still abusive. It's still bad. Still don't want to watch this. But I do think what he's doing, much like the Peachums, is presenting a negative figure and having us have to watch it. It's, you know, it's 2 hours of having to watch it. It's Sarah Kane with less nuance.
I was about to say that. The way that some of her scenes kind of, and I'm not thinking Blasted so much as like maybe Cleansed, where you're just hopping around and all of a sudden you're just in a different area and something else horrible is happening. I was like, this does feel a little bit like Sarah Kane, a little bit where you're like, oh no, what's happening next?
Well, right. Except that Sarah Kane's characters are very relatable.
Sure.
And are based in emotion, whereas his is based in intellectual problems, and he doesn't want any of his characters to be relatable, and he doesn't want the escapism of theater to be part of the equation. Whereas even Sarah Kane, though everything she's doing is garish and provocative and difficult,
it's always hopeful.
It is. It's always hopeful, and Brecht doesn't feel the need to do that, and I can actually applaud him for that in some ways. I think he gets better at it, much like Sam Shepard got better at it after Cowboy Mouth. Yeah. I think this reads like Cowboy Mouth. This reads like Peer Gynt. It reads like early, even though he, like you said, Trev, he does a lot of editing. He does a lot of forward movement on it. I do think it's hard to read. And all of his plays are hard to read. I think they're much easier to view. Even if the director doesn't even fully get it, I think I'd rather hear these plays out loud than read, because I find myself when I'm reading sort of being like, I'm sure this would be better if there was something theatrical happening in the way it's being delivered. Sure. And all I'm reading is text. So when I read Ball, all I'm thinking is like, I kind of just want to watch David Bowie do this, because there was that David Bowie
production. Yeah.
So I'm just like, I kind of want just to see this. The only versions of it I can find are in German.
I do want to disagree a little bit on the whole idea of taking out emotion. That's not what his goal was. His goal was more to strive away from empathy, because he thought if an audience was feeling empathetic to it, they won't be reflecting.
Sure.
So the emotion is still there. It's just how his thing was, how do you get away from empathy? And how do you make it where it's in kind of an uncanny valley a little bit?
Right, so, and in doing that creates a one-dimensionality and a lack of nuance that I am unable to get emotional with, right? And so I think it's more of like an audience emotion. There's a lack of emotional relatability there, which maybe isn't on purpose by him, but I find that personally.
I find it a little emotional still. Like, there's stuff to be there. It's just more like being able to break that emotion in different ways, whether it is stopping and going into a poem from a play. And he sees it more as entertainment, as we've talked about him being in the cabaret, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
To where you got to look at it as a variety show, where they like go from, we're doing the, like in his later plays, he has stuff where he'll be going into a scene and then just everybody comes out and paints a wall while singing, you know, sure. Stuff like that, to where it's like, it could be emotional. It's just like, by saying that, it has the same thing as like how Alienation versus the V Effect fucking changes it. Like saying Alienation like we do in America kind of just like distances what he tries to say, because it's not alienating the audience. It's a totally different thing, and it's bringing the audience into an engagement in a different level and seeing it as a different way.
I think that was true in the 30s and 40s. I think that's absolutely true. I think today when we present Brecht, that is not the case, and I think part of that is just America. I think part of that is just the directors currently working on Brecht. I haven't seen a lot of, and I'm not talking about adaptations, but I haven't seen a lot of true Brecht that did anything that I felt was new, or I did anything that sparked inspiration or passion in me, right? And I think there can be, you're absolutely right, there can definitely be that emotion. Audiences at your adaptation were feeling all kinds of emotions. There was there's constant verbal and you know, out loud, like, emoting happening during that show, where people were having realizations, people were going, oh my God. Or even, actually, the number one sound during your play, Trav, was,
I said Jesus a couple of times.
Yeah, a lot of people just going, that's true. That is how it is, right? And I think those are the kind of plays. The other play I saw that was kind of like that recently that brought out a lot of, like, audience engagement, and I guess you could call this emotion, especially when it's political, people get emotional about it, but was Blues for the Alabama Sky. Did anybody get to see that?
No.
Blues for an Alabama Sky, it's really fantastic, and I went and saw it at the Mark Taper, and I've never been in an audience with so many people not talking necessarily back to the actors, but like engaging with almost every line verbally. Like, it was like they'd say, like, and also I gotta work late tonight, gotta put food on the table, got a baby on the way, and like 30 people would go, that's right. Yeah. And I was just like, what?
And
what's happening? But it was kind of amazing.
Right. The last show I went to that was like that was Abortion Weekend at Hollywood Fringe.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. They would have to stop because people were standing up and clapping and cheering at them.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm sure that screwed up their timing since they had to get out.
They did a really good job with it. And plus, I think they took out a 90-minute segment and it was only a 50-minute show or something. Anyway.
They took out a 90-minute segment?
Yeah, I think they rented out for 90 minutes.
Oh, I see what you mean. I thought
their footprint was 90 minutes.
It was at one point 140 minutes, and they cut 90 minutes.
No. I wasn't being clear.
Got it.
But if anything, I will say, knowing that Brecht was 20, I mean, I've been trying to think of, like, okay, so if we did a modern day production of this, it was like gender reverse. And I'm like, no, because it still, it's just someone being cruel and awful. Like, what if you did the play exactly what it smacks of? Like, a 20-year-old dude figuring out his sexuality, just went through a breakup, and he's just filling himself up with booze because of it.
I think there's a take. Yeah. I think, which is why I say I like this play.
It's almost like Dog from Fringe. Like, just watching someone self-destruct because they can't handle something that they're going through.
Yeah, I think there's a take there because I kind of like this play, weirdly. Like, I don't know what it is about it that I still finished it and was sort of like, I want to watch David Bowie do
it. It's because it's got a swagger to it.
That's a great way to put it.
That you're just like, yeah, I get all the problems, you know, you kind of like it as much as you hate it.
I don't like Ball. I don't like him. I don't like the circumstance. I'm not sitting there going like, woot, woot, Yeah, ball.
Get him, ball. Get him.
Yeah, no. I am sitting there going like, okay, there's things here. There's things that Kane is going to pull from later. There's things that oh my God. I mean, that Susan Laurie Parks is going to pull from later. Like, we're still doing theater constantly. Oh, Annie Baker. Absolutely. Circle Mirror Transformation. Sure. It basically literally references Caucasian Chalk Circle. Like, it's like, there's... okay.
No. I get, you're absolutely right. And the way that the... And I have stuff to say next week as we start to see the ripples of his influence and what the later work is all about.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. And yes, you can tell all those people studied that. Yeah, Annie Baker, I hadn't even thought about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, because there's just like... we'll get into it. We have two whole other episodes of Talk Brecht, and I actually went deeper than I meant to about my larger opinion on him. But ball specific, is there anything else, Trav, you especially, is there anything else ball specific we want to talk about? Because we'll probably have to reference it a lot when we're discussing the evolution in the next two episodes. So anything else?
Yeah, there's some important parts of it, I think. The saving graces of this, and what I think a lot of productions probably miss because they get so distracted on ball, is it shouldn't be about ball. It's about the way these bourgeois people and the women and Eckhart all kind of like put him on this pedestal. It's the same way like we look at Bukowski, and ball is Bukowski, is where he's this piece of shit, fucking lecherous, rapist, misogynistic man who's a fucking drunk. And because he writes good words, he's on this pedestal. He's getting all this love. He's getting free booze, free gigs, whatever. He's getting published in the very first scene. And how we treat these idols. It's when we talk about... the work versus the person, but really what is the difference when you look at somebody like ball?
Sure.
You know, so that's one of the big things, is like when you're doing this, you gotta have that. What CJ was saying about a young man kind of going trying to heal his heart with his booze and shit like that, that's the adolescence and not being able to handle emotions, not being able to handle taking in that overindulgence. There's the idea of temperance in there, honestly there's the character of Eckhart even. And I disagree with Scott on Ball never had sex with a dude, because I think him and Eckhart definitely fucked in the forest.
Oh, I just meant that Brecht showing any kind of homosexual relationship on stage in 1918, he wouldn't have been
like,
able to do
you
it.
As a director would have to imply that it's not in the text.
Right. It is though, when he kills Eckhart.
Like, what does he say?
It's because he kills Eckhart because Eckhart's flirting with a woman, and he's so just jealous of this to where he kills the one.
Well,
to
me, you can
Eckhart
certainly
loves.
Play it.
Yeah, to me at that point, I'm like, oh, he's into him. That's the problem here. Like, that was the moment where everything kind of clicked for
that's
me.
That's not a homosexual
like,
relationship.
That's
just murder for crush.
Right, lust.
Crush murder. Have one last thing to share about how I would direct the final scene.
Okay.
So Ball is lying on the dirty bed, and he finally dies. And the last woodcutter is walking out, and he says, what are you thinking about? I always want to know what goes on in a man's head then. I'm still listening to the rain, he said. I went cold all over. I'm still listening to the rain, he said. Cue guitar solo from November Rain.
Yeah.
Blackout.
Little Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, I think that'd be sick, actually. No, that'd be awesome.
Don't you wish that you need somebody?
Yeah. I think there's definitely, I think Ball is one of those plays that is a great, you know, on this podcast, this happens a lot where we present something or we choose something that a modern audience, and I think CJ is a great sort of like beacon of this, where a modern audience is mostly just going to be turned off by the content and not really want to go deeper. And I don't mean you didn't go deeper, CJ. I just mean like,
sure,
there's not really a desire to free. Because of the outside layer is already a little crusty.
Well, sometimes I can't crack through my exterior of like, fuck this guy. Then I'm always excited to get on here and talk about it, because just in talking about it, y'all have kind of changed. Right. You've made me think about it harder in good ways.
And
so
I think I always want to like defend things on that level of like, okay, but yes.
Sure.
But there's a deeper thing here, and I think that's what Trav is getting to, is that there is a cream filling here that has not been tainted by the crust, right? And I think that's why is that a okay way to put it? It's like when you open up a Snickers or something, and there's like caramel on the outside that kind of got out, and like
the chocolate
got a little dusty, and it's like not really doing it. But then you bite in, and you're like, okay, but the inside's still nougat-y. I'm still having fun eating it. And I think there's a bit of that here with Ball, and I think it gets better as we move on. But this one, I think, would be very easy for a modern audience to watch or read and automatically just be like, nope, I'm not going to ever read another Brecht play. I think that's a bad decision, not a decision CJ's making, but for anybody else who has made that decision, because this is not a great Rosetta Stone for his work, right?
Not at all.
There's just so much growth after this, which is what this podcast is about.
It's his Circus Valentine.
It's his Circus Valentine. Yeah. It's his first outing that just doesn't work for everyone, and especially in a modern audience. I just don't think... I even think the most adept director probably couldn't get everyone to really appreciate this one, right? But it doesn't... He writes it in 1918. This is something I usually talk about, and I don't, I forgot to, but it doesn't receive a theatrical performance until 1923.
Wow.
When it gets performed at the Altes Theater in Leipzig, directed by Alwin Kronacher. And Brecht was actually there for most of the rehearsals.
That's fun.
But I think we're going to get much deeper into it in the next two episodes, and we can reference Ball as we do it. But CJ and anybody else as well, I do recommend, like, when you're engaging with things like this, like, find some friends like Trav and Scott and Bailey, some dudes to scream at you. Who can also
just what all
like
us women need.
Well, I don't mean that. I just mean like find episode. Other people to discuss it with so that you can get to that nougaty center, because there are things here. As Travis just mentioned, like there are things here. There are allegories here, there are metaphors here, there are philosophies here that I think even today matter. However, I think it can also be, unless you have a really adept director, I think it can also be a little simple. And that will be sort of my take in the next two episodes. I'm just setting everybody up for that. Is that I do think that once you get to that nougaty center, it is kind of just, it's a Three Musketeers. It's not a Snicker. You open it and it's just nougat. Right, like there's not a lot of peanuts and other shit.
Third less fat.
Yeah, and that's not a slight. That's actually not a slight. I think it's on purpose. I just think we as theater makers now, if we're going to do that kind of theater, we have to give it some more. We got to give it a little more. We got to get a little peanut. We got to get a little caramel.
Little nuggets.
A little pretzel, maybe. I just don't think. I think we've grown so much since this time as theater artists. But without him, much like the Beatles or any, you know, like Michael Jackson or like, sorry to bring him up, but like anybody that you can't delete from the art, you cannot delete Brecht from this art and still have theater as it is today.
Exactly. Yeah. Agreed.
And that's where we're going to get into for the next two weeks. Hey, listeners.
Can I share one of my favorite lines real quick?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the adaptation that me and CJ read, the Peter Mellencamp version, which Scott saw at Fools, there's a line that Eckhart says that is probably one of my favorite Brecht lines, is you can tell what God thought of the human race when he made the same organ you piss out of, the same organ you have sex with.
Cute.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I like that line, but what does it mean?
It means God's bullshit.
Yeah, God doesn't fucking exist.
Gotcha. Yeah, because when I hear that line, I'm sort of, I'm like searching for more. I think, interesting. I wish I had pulled out some lines that I like, because there were some lines that hit me.
It's also 1918 when like religion was so sacred. I mean, I have other sure. lines that are great that he took out, where he like talks about like this older animal. He uses like a dinosaur, and he's like, when Noah built the ark, this dinosaur didn't want to go on because he said there's no way the world's gonna flood, so he didn't get on the ark and the world flooded. And it's like this whole monologue just about this dinosaur not getting on because he didn't believe that the world could flood.
The ichthyosaur.
Yeah
There's a great video actually of Bowie doing that monologue. That's the only thing I could find of Bowie, unfortunately. All right, listener, just so you know, we have been facing you this entire time saying all of these lines directly to you.
Yeah.
because that's what we do. Okay, so that's all we have for this week, though, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything else we need to do? We got a segment we do every week, and I think everybody might have things, so we should spitlet.
LA Spotlight.
Hey, does anybody have an LA Spotlight? A spotlight on LA theater? Trav, you got anything?
Yeah, this is coming out Sunday, right?
Like it's, it Sunday? Is, yeah.
Cool. So opening this Friday is Mass Graves at Loft Ensemble, directed by Matt Lorenzo, written by Chris Eli Black. Is about a group of men in a halfway home, and yours truly is also the assistant director on it.
Awesome. Hell yeah. Cool. That's at Loft Ensemble. Look that up and follow them on all the things. We'll put that in the bio too, because I know you do a lot of work there. And we'll throw that in there. Siege, you got any spitlets?
I just wanted to make sure we punched out Maddox's workshop reading with Dan Lovato, who Scott and I just spoke to recently. There's a delightful artist spotlight coming up with them. Embers Born West with Mad Lab. It's on Sunday, October 2nd at noon, and I'm going to try really hard to be there.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, yeah. Scott, you got anything?
I do want to do a quick sort of theater adjacent shout out because our friend Jamie Andrews, former Sacred Fools member.
Jamie.
She has a film at the Lady Filmmakers Festival that's going on this weekend. Check it out at ladyfilmmakers.com. But I, strangely enough, just sheer coincidence, Jamie Andrews was the producer and starred in that production of Ball that we did at Fools.
Oh, wow.
Years ago. So just kind of funny that she
2010, I looked up when we did that. 2010
was Ball. 2010, yeah.
So people are still doing it fairly recently.
Low key, if we didn't do Ball, that's one of the shows that made me want to come to Fools, just because y'all did Ball and I was a fan of it.
So.
Was,
that's cool.
In a way, Ball brought us together, Scott, CJ, and Bailey.
Doesn't Ball always bring us together?
Balls always do that for me.
Can't say Balls.
cool, yeah. Come see Sanctuary City at the Pasadena Playhouse. It's still running for another few weeks and it is actually phenomenal. I think you three would really love it.
Yeah, I need to go. I'm really trying.
Please come see it. It's a three-person cast. It's meant to be done with no set, but the playwright was involved, and they have added a set that's pretty magical and pretty cool. And it's about, well, it's about a lot of things, but the basic idea is exactly what you think. It's about a person needing a sanctuary city. Check it out. It's really good. I don't know how
I've
to talk
amazing.
About
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no.
Far.
Yeah, no.
There's a lot to it. Yeah, but thank you all so much for joining us for part one of three of three penny. No, three podcast opera. Yeah,
you got it.
Three podcast opera. Join us next week for part two, and then part three after that. And then after that, we're also going to be doing a new bonus and stuff episode. It's a Bailey pick. It is The Wiz live.
Taking a hard right. Another hard right.
Another hard right. The Wiz live, the NBC Wiz, which I have some cool context with. I know the Dorothy. She was in Head Over Heels at the Playhouse. We had a moment. Cool. I'll tell that story later. She hit on me. We'll get there. It was great. we'll be covering that. Oh, I also want you all to go check out the artist spotlights that are dropping. We finished Maddox, you know, a while back, so go check out that entire miniseries. But we have an artist spotlight of Maddox. We have an artist spotlight coming out of Dan, the pastiche queen. We have artist spotlights coming out of all of our nominees for the Theater Playwright Award 2022. So check those out. They're all people that you just should be looking out for, whether you're in LA or not. And after The Wiz is what?
Stoppard.
Tom
Stoppard. Motherfucker.
Stop.
Yeah.
Stoppard. Yeah. We're going to do it. That's going to be super fun. So we'll get into it. Let's close it out.
Questions, comments, compliments. What are your feelings on Ball? We want to hear it, y'all. You could reach out to us via email, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Scott.
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson for writing our theme song, and our theme song is better than your theme song.
Yeah,
it's true.
He also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. We love you, Ryan Thomas Johnson. Yeah. Also, a big shout out to Pam Quinn, who wrote our Brecht-centric song, which you are about to hear. Pam is a frequent contributor to the show. We love her. Thank you so much, Pam. And then finally, to the great Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Annie Baker, who writes every single one of our episodes.
Wait!
What?
What?
Huh?
Oh, never mind. I'll tell you afterwards.
Yeah, tell me after, because it just feels like that was extraneous. Yeah. Annie, we love you.
She writes every single one of our episodes and she doesn't even know it. And one day, Annie Baker, we are going to buy you a beer.
That's right. A Hefeweizen.
A Hefeweizen.
We love you all so much. Trav, thank you so much for joining
us. Yeah, it's so good to have you. Can't wait for next week.
Can't wait for next week.
Yeah, next week will be good. And I all have so much more to say, I'm sure. So that'll be awesome. We love you guys. Mm. Subscribe, rate, review.
Wow, wow.
Do it.
It was red and yellow and green and brown and scarlet and black and ochre and peach and ruby and olive and violet and fawn and lilac and gold and chocolate and mauve and cream and crimson and silver and rose and azure and lemon and russet and gray and purple and white and pink and orange
and blue.
Later, everybody.